Kutumbeshuna Sajjeta Na Pramajet Kutumhyapi Prapashchin Nasparam Pasyed Adristam Api Dristavat Kutumbeshu to the family members. Na, not. Sajjeta, one should be attached. Na, not. Pramad yet should become crazy. Kutumbi, having many dependent family members. Api, although. Vipashchit, a wise person. Nashpadam, temporary. Pashyet, should see. Adrishtam, future rewards, such as residence in heaven. Api, indeed. Drishtavat, just like that which is already experienced. Translation. A householder taking care of many dependent family members should not become materially attached to them, nor should he become mentally unbalanced, considering himself to be the Lord. An intelligent householder should see that all possible future happiness, just like that which he has already experienced, is temporary. Purport. A family man often acts like a lord, protecting his wife, ordering his children, maintaining servants, grandchildren, domestic animals, and so forth. The words, na pramad yet kutumb yapi, indicate that although one acts like a little lord, surrounded by his family, servants, and friends, one should not, through false pride, become mentally unbalanced, considering oneself to be the actual lord. The word vipashchit indicates that one should remain sober and intelligent, never forgetting oneself to be the eternal servant of the Supreme Lord. Householders of the upper, middle, and lower classes become attached to different types of sense gratification. In any economic or social class, however, one should remember that all material enjoyment, either here or in the next life, is temporary and ultimately useless. A responsible householder should guide his family members and other dependents back home, back to Godhead, for an eternal life of bliss and knowledge. One should not become a false, puffed-up lord for a brief span of time, for then one will remain bound up, along with his family members, in the cycle of repeated birth and death. Om Jnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasati Go Bhaktivinoda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. A householder taking care of many dependent family members should not become materially attached to them. So, you may question, what's the point in taking care of family members, going through all that trouble, if you don't become attached to them? It would seem that because you are working so hard to maintain and you are tolerating so many inconveniences, whether at home or at work, therefore attachment should be there. Otherwise, what's the use? Why would one go through all this endeavor without attachment? Indeed, it seems that attachment is the reward for all your hard labors and tolerance. This is Rajogun, the mode of passion. That I will work, I will struggle, I will go through challenges, and my reward will be attachment. How is it that you can work to maintain family members, and yet you're not materially attached? This miracle can only happen in devotional service, in which the goal of every ashram, including the householder ashram, is to become attached to Krishna. We are not against attachment. We are all for attachment. Let the attachments increase and increase and increase. But we're wanting attachments to Krishna, to Krishna's pleasure. That is the difference. You may know that in the 12th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami predicts the symptoms of the age of Kali. And he says, Daksham Katumba Bharanam. In the age of Kali, if a man can just maintain one wife and two children, he's considered extremely expert. This is how fallen the age of Kali is. Just one wife and a couple of children, if you can do that, you are known to be very masterful, having great abilities. In the age of Kali, everything becomes reduced in potency. Therefore, even to maintain a small family requires the endeavor practically of, it seems, of organizing a whole army just to maintain a small family. Therefore, again, you'll wonder how it is that you can go through all the austerities and tolerances, maintaining dependents and not become attached to them. You earned the right to be attached, it seems. You've struggled, you've labored, you've persevered, you've tolerated. Therefore, you should be entitled to attachment. Otherwise, what's the point? What's the use? If you go through all this struggle and there's no attachment as the end result, who would want to endeavor in this way? The mode of passion vision dictates that there always should be a material reward to whatever you do. Bhakti, however, is all about pleasing Krishna's senses. So therefore, the attachment we're looking for is attachment to Krishna's pleasure. It's a different way of living. It's a completely different culture. How does that culture come to life? How does it become palpable? How can you taste it? That is why the association of sincere devotees is required. Otherwise, all this will be theoretical. You'll read it in the books, but how do you apply it? This is why guidance is so necessary in bhakti. And according to the devotees that you choose to keep company with, that for the most part will determine your level of advancement. Birds of a feather flock together. So even within the society of devotees, there are different levels of spiritual advancement. Water seeks its own level. Devotees associate often based on a particular level of spiritual advancement that they want. If they don't want to be so serious, they find other devotees who are not so serious. If they want to be serious, they find devotees who are serious. This is the way it works, even within the society of devotees. In other words, it's not simply one division, the non-devotees and the devotees. No. Within the devotee category, as you find out by your life in the devotional community, there are different levels of commitment, different levels of seriousness. No levels of spiritual commitment are discouraged. At the same time, we must always point out what is the standard. where we should really be going. Just like in current education, the material educational system. Everyone has to go to school. It doesn't mean that everyone in the classroom is going to be a scholar, to do well in school. But everyone has to go. So similarly, everyone has to associate with devotees. But it doesn't mean that automatically that everyone will become advanced. It depends on what you do within the classroom. It's very nice that you've enrolled in the class. That's to your credit. Now, what you do in the class is up to you. I remember when I was in what's called in the USA the eighth grade. I don't know what they call it here. Does anyone know? When you're around 13 years old or 12 years old, what level of school is that called here? So anyway, school was easy for me. At that point, I didn't have to study so much. And so I remember one morning, the teacher, because all the students would meet in one classroom for the morning, and then we would disperse to our classes during the day. It's intermediate school, it's called. So I remember one morning the teacher called me and my friend outside into the hallway to speak to us. And she said to my friend and me, "Why are you both always just so casual and not using this spare time for studies while other students are doing like that? Why is this?" I was just 12 or 13, you know. So we used to use that time before the students dispersed to their classes. We used to use that time just for joking and casual talk. So she called me out and said like that, Why don't you two do like the other students?" Not all the students were doing like that, but some were every moment they had the school books out. "We must use every moment to get ahead. We must use every moment to cram the material into our brains." Whereas my friend and me were just, you know, "Hey, what happened at the baseball game yesterday? Who won the baseball game?" So when she said like that, "Why is it that some of the other students are so eager to use every moment to study the materials? And you too, you just are so casual." So I just responded like a, you know, smart aleck 12 or 13 year old. I just said, "Oh, the other students, they need to study. They need it. It's good for them." So that shows you that even within the classroom, where everyone is entitled to go, in fact, you have to go by law, unless you're doing homeschooling, which is allowed in Australia. Even within the classroom, there are different levels according to the appetite and enthusiasm and determination of the student. We would always make fun of the students who would sit in the front of the classroom. There was the front of the classroom where all the goody-goody students would sit. The teacher would just move her eye and the students would jump. You know the example. The teacher would say jump and the students would say how high. So those are the goody-goody students. They're right in the front row looking at the teacher, looking at every movement, every gesture from the teacher, writing everything down. Their desks were very neatly arranged. Their pencils were sharp. Their pens were full of ink. And then in the middle of the classroom, there were the so-so students who, you know, sometimes would pay attention, sometimes wouldn't. And in the back of the classroom, that's where all the fun was. That's where all the cool students would be. You know, they'd be writing notes to each other and, Oh, I just remember one thing they would do. I know, it sounds pretty, it is stupid, it sounds stupid. They would throw what are called spitballs at each other. They would take, oh, you know about this? They do this in India too? Crumple up a little ball of paper, put it, wet it in your mouth and throw it at someone. They do this in India? No, I didn't think so. Yeah, we don't throw the spitballs. That was a prime pastime in Western schools. Do that. So, and everyone's laughing and joking. And the teacher would call out, please, please, pay attention. Everyone would pretend. And then she would continue on, and then we go back to passing notes and so on and so forth. So it shows you that even though everyone has the opportunity for education, not everyone takes it seriously. And sometimes even the serious students can, others will make fun of them. I used to make fun of the serious students, even though my grades were high, I didn't study so much. So I would make fun of the goody-goody students. But then I would, my karmic reactions would come when, you know, the grade reports were issued. So all the school bullies would be waiting at that time. Okay, what did you get on your grade report? Let's see it. Oh, you got all A's. We're going to beat you. You think you're smart. So I would get it then, and like karmic reactions would come upon me then. So if you see in the Society of Devotees, it's like that. It's a spiritual school. Some devotees really take it as their goal in life to go back to Godhead after this short life is done. Others think, well, for the moment, it's nice to be in Krishna consciousness. We'll see how it goes in the future. For now, this seems a good thing to do, but later, I cannot say. After all, material attachments are very strong. I don't know how long I can go on sacrificing everything for Krishna. Soon it will be time to get something for me. So how it is that one can take care of so many dependent family members and not become materially attached? We've often given the example of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who had 13 children, 12 or 13. If you want to try that, just make sure that you have the money and the energy to handle 13 children. And if one of your children is Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, then please have 20, have 30. But remember, Shukadeva Goswami has cautioned that in the age of Kali, it's so difficult if a householder can just maintain a wife and two children. He's known as very expert daksha. So Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he would dedicate everything in his home for Krishna's pleasure. He would consider himself the maintainer of Krishna's family, the protector of Krishna's family. So much so that when he would do arti in his home, because everything in his home was 100% for Krishna's pleasure, he would see his house turn into Goloka Vrindavan. So that is the topmost potential of the Grihastha Ashram. We see a warning in this verse. One should not become mentally unbalanced considering himself to be the Lord. It is not that the home is a place where it's one's own kingdom existing for the pleasure of the husband and wife. Now, the home is a place for spiritual cultivation. That's why it's called Grihastha Ashram. Just like we can use the term devotee loosely, we can also use the term grihastha loosely. But actually, grihastha is a very high platform. It means someone who lives in family life only for the purpose of spiritual advancement. That is grihastha life. It's not that anyone who just puts on a white dhoti and is married is a grihastha. The symptoms have to be there. Those symptoms are that everything in the home is dedicated for Krishna's pleasure. That's a grihastha. When the mental unbalancing comes, then we consider, I am the Lord of my circumstances. And all problems come from that attitude. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Ishvaro aham bhogi, siddoham balavan sukhi. I'm the controller. I'm the enjoyer. I'm perfect. Everything I do is so expert. And I'm so happy when I'm in control. This is the mentally unbalanced attitude. Another point we see in this verse is that one should use the intelligence. An intelligent householder should see. What should the intelligent householder see? That all possible future happiness is the same as the happiness you've already experienced, in that it is temporary. In other words, use your brains. Think of your past experiences. See your past experiences through the eyes of Shastra. The so-called happiness that you already experienced came and went, so flickering. So similarly, any material happiness that you can imagine for the future, it'll be the same. So why should we think there's anything special awaiting us on the material platform? Yesterday on the cruise, we had a very nice cruise, about 270 persons, and we spoke about something that social researchers have stumbled upon, although it's right there in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. They call it the impact bias. They've noticed that the human mind cannot accurately predict emotional impacts in the future. That the mind constantly overestimates the happiness that you'll get by acquiring something in the future. And even the mind overestimates the distress that you'll get when some setback happens. So there's something about the mind that's always exaggerating both the happiness and the distress. Whether it's about a consumer acquisition, a new car or a bigger house, or getting married or having a child, or getting a divorce and getting someone else, the mind always overshoots the mark, imagining the emotional impact that you're going to get. You have to really watch this mind. That's stated in the fifth canto. This is cheating. It's hard for our false ego to accept that we have a mind that cheats us. Because the mind makes everything look so appropriate, doesn't it? I'll do this, and then I'll get that. And you project ahead into the future the emotional impact that you're going to get. Oh, it's going to be nice. I can just see now how I'm going to feel in the future if I do this. He explained that this understanding is very close to the understanding of rasa, how everyone is pursuing through their activities a particular taste, through their working hard, through their philanthropy, through their any activity, their relationships. They're looking for taste, and they're imagining to themselves what it's going to taste like. What's the rasa going to be like? Understanding that the mind always misrepresents the emotional impacts of the future, you can save yourself a lot of trouble. You can catch yourself imagining, oh, when I get this, how nice I'm going to feel. And study how the mind cheats you. How do you do that? Think of the past when you thought, I have to have this, I have to have that. And you became so desperate in the past. And now you think, oh, it was no big deal. Think when you were a little child and you had to have a certain toy or you had to have your way. I remember when I was about 13, maybe 14, I think 13, and my younger brother, he was 11 and a half. So I had a very, how do you say, special sweater. I thought it was very special, a jumper you called here. So at that time, at that age, both my brother and I, we would go to school and we would work before we went to school. Because my mother was very expert. She said, if you want money, go out and get it yourself. She didn't want any of her children to be lazy or she wanted them to understand the value of a dollar. So we would get up 4 o'clock in the morning and distribute newspapers in the neighborhood. Like I distributed 125 houses, and getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Good training for later devotional life. So, we would buy everything. We were financially self-sufficient at that age. We didn't pay rent for the house, and we didn't pay for food, but everything else, clothes, school transport, we all paid for from our work. So, I bought this special jumper. It zipped from the neck down. It really was outstanding. I would wear it to school very proudly. So then, one morning, as I was about to dash to school, because I went to school later than my brother, he went 9 to 3, I went 11 to 4. So I woke up after napping, after delivering the newspapers. I took a little nap and then got ready to go to school. I looked for my sweater. It was missing. Where is my sweater? How am I going to profile at school today? How am I going to be the all-attractive? I was too shy to talk to any girls, but I thought the sweater would do it. So I couldn't find it. And very quickly I came to the conclusion what had happened. A great disaster. A great catastrophe. My younger brother had taken my sweater and worn it to school. Oh, this was horrible. This was war. So I came home from school that evening. He would get home before me. And I immediately ran up to him. You wore my sweater. You know, I don't know what you're talking about. You took my sweater. You wore it. Admit it. And we jumped on each other and we battled. He was younger than me, but he was bigger than me, but still. I psychologically intimidated him due to being the older brother. And psychologically, he had to submit, even though he was physically bigger. Admit it, you wore my sweater. And finally, yes, I'm sorry. Now I think back to that, and I think, oh, stupid. Okay. But at the time, it was a major event. The mind convinces you, this is so important. He has violated a moral code. He has worn your sweater for the day. A sweater that you worked for. And he's going to have all the girls look at him. So, this is obviously ridiculous. But just think the things we do now that we think are so necessary. I have to have it. And then in the future we look back and say, what is the big deal? It's good to talk to your grandparents about this if they have some realization. They'll explain to you how they had so many dramas in life in which they took so seriously, but actually all that's going on is the passing of time. That's all that's going on. The time factor is chasing us invisibly. And we're making a big deal about all these productions. You can think young teenage boys and girls. The boys, perhaps they're taking their sports so seriously. It's very crucial with how they're playing the sports and whether their favorite sports team wins. The girls, they're gossiping about this, chit-chatting about this and that, taking it so seriously. As if no one in the world can understand how deep this subject matter is. The boys are strutting around with their egos as if they don't rule the world, you know, they'll commit suicide. Everyone laughs at this now. But look at the things that we do today. And we take it to be so important. So crucial. I must have this. And I will feel better when I get it. At the time of death, all these attachments are lost. But unless we learn how to deal with material attachment itself, we'll carry that propensity for material attachment into our next life. So therefore, the bhakti system is to purify the attachment by connecting everything to Krishna's pleasure. This takes practice. This takes guidance. By chanting Hare Krishna attentively, you are equipped with the vision to see everything in connection to Krishna. Without properly taking shelter of the holy name, it's very difficult to see where is Krishna's pleasure. And even if you get guidance, you may not have the humility to accept the guidance because the mind is so rebellious. So our daily challenge is to hear the holy name with attention. We'll never give up trying. We'll never think, now I have achieved the goal. We follow in the footsteps of Mahaprabhu who said, Dadaivam Ijasa Mahajana Naraga. I'm so unfortunate I have no attachment to the holy name. So in bhakti, we are not against attachment. We are all for attachment. But the attachment is for Krishna's pleasure. All right, we'll stop here. Any questions? Yes.
And you spoke so nicely yesterday and today about how the mind creates these false expectations for happiness and stress. I'm wondering, does the same thing apply in devotional service? Should I expect to be satisfied when serving Krishna? Should I not expect anything?
You will be satisfied, but on the higher levels of devotional service, you don't act for your satisfaction. You act for Krishna's pleasure. There are different levels, as I explained, just like in the classroom. Just the fact that someone is serving Krishna, we're very happy about that. But there are different levels of devotion. We're not going to, you know, interrogate everyone here, like a secret police interrogation. All right, tell me, are you serving Krishna for your satisfaction? If you are, we're going to put you in a forced labor camp. You should only serve Krishna for his pleasure. all those who have the inferior motives will be persecuted. No, we don't do that. Just like in the second canto of Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami says, Akama, Sava Kama Va, Moksha Kama, Daji. Whether you're free of material desires, full of material desires, or you're lusty for liberation, engage in devotional service with the concentration of a beam of sunlight. Tivrena Bhakti Yogena. Gradually, by engaging in devotional service, we become purified, so that acting for Krishna's pleasure becomes a reality, not a theory. I often explain about karma yoga. Karma yoga means you sacrifice the results of your activities to Krishna, but you are attached to acting in a certain way. Material life means you're attached to the results and what you do. Karma yoga means you're attached to what you do, but you give the results to Krishna. Full bhakti, in the fullest sense, bhakti means you're not attached to what you do and you're not attached to the results. Most devotees should be looking up to karma yoga, not down at it. There's no need to artificially imagine oneself to be more advanced than what one is. But you can work toward that goal, and you should know about the goal and hear about the goal. We don't want devotees artificially saying, oh, it doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter what ashram I'm in. Everything for Krishna's pleasure. Whether I work or not, or have a house or not, it doesn't matter. It's everything for Krishna's pleasure. You have to situate yourself properly so you can peacefully make spiritual advancement. So, therefore we say to people, all right, you're working. Use the results for Krishna's pleasure. You have a house. Use the house for Krishna's pleasure. You have a family. Use the family for Krishna's pleasure. And then gradually you can make spiritual advancement to get to the point in which you can genuinely act without attachment to any situation or any activity. Well, and of course, you're giving the results to Krishna. Anything else? Yes?
Every day, you have to love the lotus feet of Krishna. So why is it so important to the lotus feet?
Because that's respect. You approach a superior person at the feet first. Therefore, when you come to view the deities, you first put your vision to the feet and then raise the vision up. It's actually disrespectful to approach a superior person and just get right up into their face and stare into their eyes.
And also because lotus feet are very attractive.
Huh?
Lotus feet are very attractive and beautiful.
Everything about Krishna is very attractive and beautiful. Out of respect, you put your vision to the feet and then raise your eyes to the lotus face of the Lord.
Some people also say because all the devotees are also sitting on the lotus feet of Krishna. All the pure devotees.
You can say like that. But actually it's done out of respect. Anything else? Yes? You have to see who is enjoying the results. Just like you may get a choice, should you take this job or that job? Then you analyze what is best for my spiritual life. One job may give more money, but it'll take up more time and put me in more anxiety, and that my spiritual life may be affected. So if I take the less paying job, it doesn't mean I'm going to starve. It means I'll have more time for Krishna consciousness. So one always evaluates decisions in that way. If one is considering marriage, then you can look and see what is the best candidate for my Krishna consciousness, not what is the best candidate for my my material stimulation. Yes.
I learned that Krishna, his form, got his pastimes among different. Then why simultaneously today, as I mentioned, we shouldn't be attached to what we are doing, our service? Because ultimately, that is also attachment to Krishna. Right?
You're attached to your duty. But suppose your service changes. You're attached to giving Krishna pleasure, whether this way or that way. In the beginning, it's all right to be attached to your service. You may think that, but I like computers, so now for Krishna, I will be on the computer all day. That's all right in the beginning. But as you become more purified, you are eager to serve Krishna in any way you're asked to. You're attached to the duty of pleasing Krishna. You're attached to the responsibility. You're grateful that Krishna's given you a chance. Whatever service he's given you, you're grateful for the opportunity to do it for Krishna's pleasure. So duty consciousness is what we should be focusing on in the beginning and in the middle stages. Duty means whether I feel like doing something or not, I do it. For Krishna's pleasure.
When we become or we take up Krishna consciousness, people feel like we are ignoring them and becoming selfish. So how do we justify ourselves?
Which people feel like that?
Our friends, family, or whoever we know.
It takes some time for the family to start to understand devotional activities. Just be patient. Gradually they will see the qualities of the devotee shining. As for material friends, are they important? What is so important about material friends? Make devotees your friends. And then that misunderstanding won't be there. Material friends will always misunderstand because they're your friends for material purposes. They can't do anything for your spiritual life. Family members, all right, you have this body, and this body is in relation to other bodies. You can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family members. So therefore, act in a way that gradually they'll see the qualities of a devotee. It happens. Thank you very much, Hare Krishna.